Good morning, everybody. It is the second day of November here in 2021, the day after All Saints Day. Finally, we have some snow here in the Adirondacks down at our elevations. We've had snow-covered peaks for a while, but yesterday we had some snow flurries in the air. And today, according to some reports, we're supposed to get up to an inch of snow out there. My kids will be out there sliding and throwing and rolling in that snow. So will my dog. Cannot wait for the white stuff to come down here. Let's get into our topic for today, which is a news roundup. We have to do this because it's not looking pretty out there, folks. We've got disasters to the left of them, disasters to right of them, like the charge of the Light Brigade, only instead of cannon, we have disasters. So let's begin sadly. Sadly, let's begin in Nigeria. We had a high-rise collapse there just yesterday. Different reports, 21 stories or 25 stories, still under construction. But either way, this is a big building, a big skyscraper. In 2020, I guess a company called Prowess Engineering pulled out, citing low-quality concrete, concerns over the building plans and how they were being implemented. Death toll right now is only at 6 confirmed, but expected to go higher. Several dozen more, mostly construction workers, suspected to be trapped. Very much a concern that the death toll will go higher there. And I will point out this is too common in Nigeria. Way too common to have building collapses going on there. Remember, a school in Lagos collapsed in 2019, killing 20 kids. Just a couple of years ago, other building collapses are happening there. You can look it up. It's a known problem. Of course, the news reports are blaming this on too lax regulations being too lax there and the government not bothering to enforce their codes. Nobody is suggesting that maybe the government wouldn't be the best agency, the best organization to be in charge of building safety, since it's about government and not about construction. But hey, the point is, this is a tragedy, and this is Lagos, right? The financial capital of Nigeria. It is undergoing explosive growth right now. If you're not up on your Lagos facts, 2,000 people migrate into Lagos every single day. Many people project Lagos to be the number one most populated city in the world by the end of the century, by 2100, if these trends continue. Right now, nobody's even sure how many people are in the city. You can find credible estimates anywhere from 11 million to 20 million. Just a huge range right there. Nigeria and Lagos, in fact, not just the financial capital of Nigeria. The real capital of Nigeria, of course, is the political capital, is that planned city right in the middle of the country. I think they planned it in the 1980s. It's Abuja. But Lagos, the biggest city, the financial capital, kind of what New York was or is in the United States. And most importantly, frankly, the most important thing about Lagos, in my opinion, is it is the capital of Nollywood, right? It is Nollywood, in fact. And if you're not familiar with Nollywood, well, among the top three cities or film industries, let's go national, national film industries, among the top three national film industries in terms of the number of feature productions put out per year, where does Nollywood rank, and what are the other two? Do you know? Well, in fact, if you just measure a film industry by the number of feature films produced per year, Nollywood, obviously they call it Nollywood because it's Nigeria and their version of Hollywood. If you just go by number of feature films produced per year, Nollywood is number one. 2,600, give or take, feature films per year produced in Nigeria. Tremendous film industry in Nigeria. And also tremendous cinema and theater town, too. So number two on the list, Bollywood, India, with 2,400. Number three on the list, if you said Hollywood, then you are wrong. Because number three on the list is China, producing about 800 feature films per year. Number four on the list, Japan, 700. Then clocking in is the United States at 650. And then jumping way down to South Korea at 340. And then you have France, Spain, UK, Germany between 300 and 200 each. So if you add up those big four UK countries, you get 1,000, which is bigger than the China, Japan, US tier. So in terms of number of feature films produced, it's the top tier is Nollywood and Bollywood at about 2,600, 2,400. Then you've got that middle tier of China, Japan, US from 800 down to 650. Then you take another big step down to South Korea and the EU tier with 340, South Korea, and then France, Spain, UK, Germany between 300 and 200 each. So that's it in terms of the film industry and in terms of the number of feature films produced by each national industry per year. By the way, if you want to do it in terms of box office revenue, not just number of feature films produced, but the box office revenue, well, it's China. China number one with a bullet, $3 billion. U.S. only $2.2 billion. EU also $2.2 billion. And that, my friends and droogs, is why you see so many Chinese movies now, even from Hollywood, like Shang-Chi and Everest and The Meg. Everything is pro-Chinese. I don't know about Nollywood. Is Nollywood producing a lot of pro-Chinese films, trying to take advantage of that giant Chinese $3 billion box office market? I don't know. Let me know. Find me on Twitter, ADK Homeroom, and give me the news. What's the Nollywood penetration in the China box office? I suspect it's not too big. And I have to tell you that I don't know for sure whether Bollywood has taken a turn toward China appeasement like Hollywood has, or China pandering, perhaps we should say, like Hollywood has. And oh my gosh, right? John Cena can't even say that Taiwan's its own country without having to apologize over and over again to China. Well, guess what? I can pretty comfortably say that Salman Khan and the other stars of Bollywood are not kowtowing to China, are not trying to capitalize on the Chinese market. I don't think that there is too much interest there, given the respective stances of those two countries. I'm sure there's some, but at least from my viewing, I don't see anything like it. Let's see. Sometime I'll have to do a podcast on Bollywood films. I must admit I'm not too up on Nollywood films, but Bollywood films, you know, if you haven't been watching your Bollywood, if you haven't been keeping up with that, there are some great ones out there. Let's go on to our next news item, our next disaster of the day. Let's start out with a big one. American Airlines canceled over 2,000 flights over the holiday weekend. Holiday being Halloween here, of course, and then All Saints Day yesterday, but Halloween, much the larger holiday. And isn't that an interesting statement? Isn't that an interesting statement that Halloween has become, with its ghouls and its goblins and its scary jack-o'-lanterns, has become much the larger holiday over All Saints Day, its namesake. Interesting. Almost kind of like Dante's Inferno, much more popular than Paradiso and Purgatorio. And in general, you know, Paradise Lost, much more popular than Paradise Found from Milton. In general, the bad guys always getting the press, always the bigger hit. The bad guy always gets the girl. Oh my goodness. Interesting. interesting to note that little trend there. So the holiday weekend was Halloween, and American Airlines decided to pull a Southwest. That's right. They're putting on their orange, yellow, and blue, and they are having a protest over the vaccine mandates. Now, are we sure it's a vaccine protest? After all, they haven't really come out and said, hey, we're protesting the vaccine mandates, so that's why you can't fly across the country. Well, let's think. American Airlines blamed it on the weather. Somehow this weather affected only American Airlines and didn't affect anybody else. Also, we have had rumors in the social media spheres over the last fortnight or so predicting such a job action at American Airlines. Third, there are all these labor rules that prohibit unions and the employer from discussing matters like this, and certainly the people in the union cannot say, because of the labor rules, that they are on strike in this way. They can only have a sick out, or they can only have just coincidence causing them all to be out on the same day. They can't officially claim it, or they will be in legal hot water. So combining all those factors, I'd say, heck yes. A big old Napoleon Dynamite, heck yes. For this one, it is definitely a vaccine mandate protest. And will it be effective? Well, in yesterday's podcast, we talked about the fact that boycotts, now obviously this is different than strikes, but boycotts generally do not work. Go and listen to that if you didn't get a chance. That's in the top seven arguments against libertarianism and why they're wrong. So today, strikes are a little bit different than boycotts, but you know what? They really don't generally fare much better. If you look through the biggest strikes in the United States, you see failure after failure, right? The textile strike in 1934, railroad shop worker strike in 1922, USX Steel. I don't know if it was USX then, but US Steel Corporation in 1919. They all failed. Some of those, the workers even had to settle for five cents lower pay per hour. I think that was the steel one after the strike ended. They can be, I guess, strikes a little bit more effective than boycotts. You know, I think of the United Auto Workers in the 1980s and 70s in Detroit. But that was really more than just strikes. That was a constant, decades-long attack on the industry. And of course, you saw in 2008 how that all panned out. Everybody but Ford should have gone bankrupt. And Ford really just due to the good luck of their refinancing timing. So the UAW constant pressure really did sort of doom the industry there. And it wasn't just a strike. What really happened there was that the UAW leveraged the power of the government, right? What really worked is that they got the government on their side and they forced the other side to give in through the power of law. And that's really when a strike starts to work, is if you have the government backing you up and forcing the other side, if the other side is the employers, right, forcing them not to hire other workers, preventing free trade, preventing the right to contract, that sort of government intervention and interference in the marketplace, that's what can really tip the scales in favor of a strike. But guess what? Unfortunately, in the American Airlines case, the government has already chosen a side. And it is the vaccine mandate side against the unions. We'll see how that works out for you in the elections. Government, I guess in this case, Biden happens to be in power in the government. See how that works out for you in the elections there. Cough, Virginia, cough. So the government's already chosen a side here. I don't think there's a whole lot of hope for huge effects from this strike. Nonetheless, it is nice to see It would be wonderful if they did overturn the mandates. I'm not holding out a huge amount of hope for this. There's a chance that it might actually convince the employers, Southwest, American Airlines, to drop their federal business, so they wouldn't be, there's a possibility that they'd be able to get out of being considered federal contractors. Then I believe that something only like 5 or 10% of their business is federal. Still, though, I doubt that even that will happen. I doubt that they will even try to drop their federal contractor status, because they have relied on government interference on their behalf before. They don't want to give that up, these giant airline companies. They have also been recipients of huge bailouts over the years, most recently during COVID just a year ago. So most likely this will not overturn the vaccine mandates because of what I just said. Strikes aren't too effective unless you have the government on your side. And I doubt it will even convince is my Newfoundland up there making some noises? Calm down there, dog. Calm down. So I doubt it will even convince the airlines to try to end their federal contracts. I don't think we will even get that out of this job action. What needs to happen, or what will affect change here, is the elections. Once again, I say cough, Virginia, cough. Once an election happens that turns the government to the side of the people on strike here, then you will start to see change. I think elections, much more than boycotts, certainly much more than boycotts and more than strikes, are more likely to be successful here. And by the way, since we're talking about American Airlines, I have to point out, don't you wish you had bought one of those AA Air Passes, those Fly Forever A Air Passes, American Airlines Air Pass, back in 1980, I think, is when they first went on sale. From 1980 to 1997, they were on sale. The cost of the pass was $250,000, launched in 1980, or maybe it was 81. That's $711,000 in 2020 dollars. So for $711,000, that's a chunk of change to be sure, but you could fly whenever you wanted, as much as you wanted. You pay your $711,000, and then for the rest of your life, you can fly on American Airlines wherever, whenever you wanted. Oh my goodness! That was a deal, right? And by 1990, the price was increased up to $600,000, which is the equivalent of about $1.2 million in 2020 dollars. By 1993, the American Airlines company had realized that they were undercharging for this, and the price was up to $1 million in 1993, which would be $1.8 million in 2020 dollars. And then in 1994, they ended the practice because it was not working out for them. It sure did work out for the people who bought it, though. Wow, what a deal. They did come back one year, by the way, 2004, Neiman Marcus Christmas catalog, $3 million for the pass. And nobody bought it in 2004 for $3 million. Interesting. You could always get a companion pass, also $2 million for the companion pass in 2004. I think by then maybe private jets had become competitive with that. I'm not sure. Certainly, I do know that when I was teaching in New York City in 2004, a lot of my students, I taught at a Gossip Girl school, right? Extremely, extremely rich young people there. And they were all about the private jets. Once in a while, I'd have somebody come in and say, oh, I have to be at the airport on time today. Oh, woe is me. And I'd say, what? What? At first, I said, what? What do you mean you have to be? You always have to be at the airport on time. And then the person would say, no, I'm flying commercial today. And I would say, oh, yeah, okay. Yeah, you do have to be on time for those commercial flights. All right, next on the agenda here, vaccine mandates. We'll continue with a little bit of that. Still dominating the news cycle, Joe Allen, that Harvard public health professor who has called for an end to school mask mandates by January 1st, even for unvaccinated kids, Yesterday, he tweeted that vaccine mandates work for their stated goal of increasing the number of people vaccinated. Well, that is true, Professor Allen, and that is the benefits, assuming that the vaccines don't turn out to be I am legend type stuff, which is unlikely in the extreme. I am vaccinated. I fully vaccinated. I recommend it all adults get vaccinated. But that tweet, I just have to point out, when people talk about this, when people talk about vaccine mandates, they are often ignoring the costs. And starting yesterday in New York City, we had some big news items coming out. What are those costs? Well, obviously, one is the American Airlines flight delays we saw this weekend. That's a cost of the vaccine mandates. And sure, that's people's choice, but that is always going to happen. There are people who are going to resist these things. And yesterday in New York City, you saw 26 firehouses close. According to the Daily Mail, that is one third of all of the fire department of New York is remaining unvaccinated. New York City is calling for people from where I live, way up here in the Adirondacks, in the boondocks, to come down and please, please, please help them in New York City. They're trying to steal our firefighters, just like they try to steal our ventilators. They tried to steal our ventilators at the start of the pandemic, and now they're trying to steal our firefighters. This is not going well, folks. This is not a good sign of management when your big city, your jewel city, has to be stealing equipment and supplies and manpower from the hinterlands. This is not how you want to manage a crisis. Hashtag leadership. Doesn't matter if it's Cuomo, doesn't matter if it's Hochul. Big problems here in New York. De Blasio, obviously, mayor of the city. So they're begging, right? People are going to die in fires down there because of this. 6 firehouses closed in Manhattan, 9 in Brooklyn, 4 in Staten Island, 3 in Queens, 4 in the Bronx. And it's not just New York City either, right? The Los Angeles sheriff yesterday says he is seeing, quote, a mass exodus. Nice biblical imagery there. 20 to 30% of his personnel are unavailable to work now. 3,000 out of 10,000 of his sworn personnel are refusing to come in or to be vaccinated or still in the process of seeking exemptions and unavailable to come in. And of his civilian workforce, 2,000 out of 6,000 remain unvaccinated, even now after November 1st. So bottom line, I guess it's safe to say that if, as Joe Allen says, vaccine mandates are working, they're working only for their stated goal of increasing the vaccinated population. And I think that is true. But overall, on net, are they producing a positive result? That is a much murkier question, much harder to divine an answer to that question than to just look at the benefits and say, oh yeah, the numbers of vaccinated people are going up. But what will be the results of this massive shortage of workers in some of the most critical fields? We don't know. We don't know what that effect will be, but I have a feeling we're going to find out, at least in gross terms. We will see. We will see. And also, I don't think the vaccine mandates, I think they're having a cost, a political cost, right? I think they're not working in terms of the political face that they put forward. And that leads us into our next topic, I guess, here, which is Virginia. McAuliffe versus Youngkin over there in Virginia. Completely self-inflicted wounds by the Democratic Party right here. So in recent days, the Republican has caught up to the Democrat, of course, and passed him. 538 and RCP have him in lead by a point or two in their polls, within the margin of error, as they say. Which, by the way, isn't that just aggravating that people put in a margin of error on political polls? Because let's say that you predict, as 538 did, that there's a 25% chance or so that Trump will win in 2016. And then it happens, and everybody says, oh, come on, you predicted 75% chance the other way. And then 538 and Nate Silver say, oh, but we said there was a quarter chance, a 25% chance that Trump would win. So we're safe. We covered that. This is silly, right? This is anthropic reasoning. This is so silly because, well, even if you say there's a 1% chance, let's say you say there's a 1% chance that candidate Joe wins, and then candidate Joe ends up winning. And people say, come on, you predicted 99% chance the other way. And then you just say, well, I said there's a 1% chance that candidate Joe would win, and that means that I'm covered, right? There's a 1% chance. This is the 1%. It happened, and I said it could happen, so I'm covered. These people, these predict, these pollsters, just make a prediction one way or the other. Just make a prediction one way or the other, and you can tell us the odds you think that you'll be wrong in your prediction. That might be useful information. But to come out and say no matter what happens, right, the way they do it now, no matter what happens, the pollsters are always right. And it's not like you can go back and run the same election, you know, 1,000 times and see if the 1,000 different results match up to their percentages that they predicted. It's just silly to do it that way. It's meaningless. Just give us a prediction. Tell us the odds that you think are wrong. That's how political polls should be reported. Anyway, what's going on in Virginia? Well, the Democratic Party's basically committing suicide, right? They're digging into this topic and doubling down on this topic of critical race theory. McAuliffe was an idiot to say that parents shouldn't have a say in what is taught to their kids at school. People care about what is taught to their kids at school, and they have every right to have a voice, in fact, the controlling voice of what is taught to their kids in school. Go back to some of the first podcasts I did at the beginning of or in the middle of September, if you want to read my take as a 25-year veteran of the teaching force here in public schools and independent schools in America, my take on what is actually being taught. I should probably update that now, given the importance of this issue in the Virginia election. But I'll tell you, it's not pretty. And when proponents of critical race theory say, oh, we're just teaching about the actual history of race in America, no. That is absolutely not what they are doing. They are presenting a completely one-sided view of history. They are telling everything horrible about the traditional United States values, the traditional American values, everything horrible about free markets, everything, every accident, every tragedy that ever happened as a result of loving freedom, loving liberty, standing up for business, standing up for individual rights, everything that is traditionally viewed as American, they are presenting as evil by only showing one side of it. Meanwhile, the savages out there, the tribes, I believe in the independent Declaration of Independence, Thomas Jefferson described them as merciless savages, the tribes of Native Americans that lived on the periphery of the expanding United States back in the day and did things like here in Cuylerville, New York, when Little Beard captured two U.S. Army officers. When he captured two, this is spoiler, skip over this next part if you don't want to hear it, right? He sliced open their guts, he tied their intestines to a tree trunk. That tree is still there in Cuylerville, New York, and he whipped them around their tree until they died. And this is the sort of savage culture that the United States was pushing into, right? And in critical race theory classrooms, they say that being opposed to that culture and being in favor of the American culture is racist. There's nothing racist about it. Race does not determine culture, right? You can be whatever race you want, and you can choose whatever culture you want. Race does not determine culture. You can be against a particular culture, like the culture of human sacrifice and cutting somebody's bowels open and whipping around a tree, or the culture of what happened to the woman who was abducted in Texas, Rachel Plummer. She was abducted in Texas by Comanches in the 1820s, and published a book about it once she was rescued. And you can read, again, spoilers here. You know what? I'm not even going to go into it. It's too gross. Just go and read about what happened to her and what was done to her infant children. So you can be opposed to culture without being racist. Race and culture are two separate ideas. Okay, you can have whatever culture you want, no matter what race you are. But that is not what is being taught in critical race theory classrooms. Critical race theory classrooms, and not even those classrooms, just any, almost any history or social studies classroom in the United States right now, kids are being taught that your race determines your culture. And if your skin is a certain color, then you will think one way. And if your skin is another color, then you will believe another set of ideas. So that is what's going on in classrooms. And it is absolutely horrid that it's almost unthinkable that McAuliffe would commit such a blunder as to say that parents shouldn't have a say in what is taught to their kids at school, and that he would come out and support critical race theory. That's why he is now losing, and his opponent is going to win. I am predicting that, unlike the pollsters who hide behind their percentages, and then no matter what comes true, they can say, oh, well, there was a percentage that this would happen, and this is the chance. Well, I'm going to go out and call it. I'm saying there is a Republican victory coming up in Virginia today. That's what I'm calling. We'll see if I'm right tomorrow. I wouldn't say that I am extremely confident in this prediction, but I think that it is going to go that way. I would say low to moderate confidence in my prediction. And we'll find out. We'll find out, as long as you trust our polls, we'll find out what happens tomorrow. Let's see what else is in the news. Over in Pakistan, PEMRA, that's the Pakistani Electronic Media Regulatory Authority, which I find interesting that there is such a handily available acronym in English. Are they not using Urdu for their governmental agencies, for their acronyms there? I don't know. I would have expected an Urdu name. Anyway, they have banned hugs on TV. They say it's against Pakistani values, against Islamic teaching. It's vulgar. They say they've received many complaints on WhatsApp and various other places. Now, one of the reasons this is interesting is that it allowed for one of the sickest burns I've seen in a while from human rights activist Rena Omer. Rena just absolutely destroyed, completely dunked on PEMRA here in the Pakistani government. See, because the Pakistani government, they said that hugs and caresses are showing a disregard for Islamic teachings and not a true reflection of Pakistani society. That is a quote. And so then Omar just laid the smack down, and she tweeted back at them. She said, for once, PEMRA got it right. Caresses and hugs and love between married couples is not Pakistani culture. We are, in fact, a culture of control, abuse, and violence. Ouch! Just straight up pwned. Pwned by the pog right there. Rena Omer with the fantastic response. We have to keep moving on here. Let's look. Next news item up. You have COP26 going on in Scotland. Big climate conference there. I like Scotland a lot. Love the hills. Love Edinburgh. I was lucky enough to be in Edinburgh when one of the Harry Potter movies came out. I think it was number 6, so people were aware that there weren't going to be too many more premieres going on, and they had to make a big deal out of this one. Oh, it was delightful. The castle up there on the hill, it is truly Hogwarts. It is a great place to visit, to see fantastic walking city. And those closes, those like sunken, closed-in, fallen alleyways along the Royal Mile off on the side there, they're spooky. And haunting, honestly haunting. All right, so what's going on at the climate conference? Well, hilariously, the countries there just pledged to end deforestation by 2050. So the United States, not on the hook for that one, because true, we only have 8% of the world's trees here in the United States, but we have a lot more trees now than in the year 1900. So you kind of picture the United States signing on to that and thinking, oh, end deforestation by 2050? I'll take that credit. Check mark. Give me some of that political goodwill because I'm already doing that, right? And we don't just have a little bit more forestation here in 2021 than we did in 1920 in the United States. We have a heck of a lot more. Do you want to guess how much more? Want to guess? We're talking forest volume growth is 380% bigger, almost four times bigger in 2020 than in 1920. That is crazy. And nowhere is better situated to see that, by the way, than my own town here in the Adirondacks. Because if you look at pictures from 100 years ago here, you can see it's barren. It is barren. Everything is cleared for farmland here. And now I walk out my front door and I can't see, you know, I live in the middle of the woods, right? My driveway winds through giant trees to get out to our little neighborhood road here. My entire neighborhood is forested. We have forests everywhere. Sucks for the meadowlarks, right? They like meadows. No more meadowlarks here in the Adirondacks. But on the other hand, we have bears because bears do like the trees. So yay, bears. Get bears in my driveway and coyote running through my backyard. So yeah, the U.S. gets a pass on that deforestation one. Brazil, of course, might have little work to do there. They pledged to it anyway. But if you're worried about deforestation in the Amazon because of oxygen loss, remember to keep in mind that that NOAA, National Oceanic Atmospheric Administration here in the United States, says up to 80% of the Earth's oxygen doesn't come from trees at all, right? It comes from the ocean, algae in the ocean. So to some extent, right, all of this, by the way, not just the deforestation, to some extent, it, from an American point of view, United States point of view, this is OPP. This is Naughty by Nature 1991, that single OPP using the Jackson 5 sample there. This is OPP because other people's problem, right? That's not exactly what it stood for in the song, but close. Close to that. And I know it's sacrilege for anybody to say, oh, this is some other person's problem. But we kind of specialize in sacrilege here on this podcast, don't we? We specialize in sacrilege. And just look at the numbers, right? CO2 emissions in the United States are down a crazy amount. The United States is doing great on carbon emissions. People are saying, oh, carbon emissions so terrible. In the United States, they are going down and they are going down precipitously. I wouldn't quite say they're falling off a cliff because the graph is not vertical and cliffs imply verticality, but we are at least talking Mount Crumpet type of steepness here, right? We are talking the Grinch, really steep that hill outside of Whoville, Mount Crumpet here. That's what you look at when you see the U.S. CO2 emissions chart. In 2020, United States carbon dioxide emissions were 4.6 billion metric tons. That is down 11% from 2019. And it's the same level as, do you want to guess what year? 1983. That's going back 40 years now. Our emissions, CO2 emissions are already down to 40 years. Now I can hear what some of you are saying. You're saying, oh, come on, Frank. This is silly to talk about 2020 numbers because that was the COVID year and everybody stayed home. So of course it's down. Well, okay, fine. But you know what? Even if you go to 2019, you're still talking Mount Crumpet. It is still a precipitous decline because, you know, in 2019, our last blessed year before Order 666 took place, what do we get then? 5.28 billion metric tons, the same as what year? 1993. So you're still going back 30 years. The CO2 emissions in 2019, our last blessed pre-order 666 year, were down to back to 1993 levels. The peak was in the mid-2000s, the naughty oddies there. So U.S. CO2 emissions have been going down a lot, and if we expect this trend to continue, then why would you kill yourselves with legislation and treaties like Biden is interested in? I don't know why you would do that. This trend is showing no signs of slowing down. Should just see where it goes before you sign some crippling legislations. And if you look at per capita CO2 emissions, it's even more pronounced. Now, I know what matters for anthropogenic global warming is the absolute amount emitted, but if you look at per capita numbers, then you have to go back to, if you're using the 2020 numbers, you have to go back to 1949, which is an anomalous year, and before that to the 1930s in the Great Depression to find equal numbers of per capita CO2 emissions in the United States. We're talking the Great Depression. So two things. One, that kind of jumps out at you. When are the last two times that we had per capita carbon dioxide emissions this low? 2020 and the Great Depression. What do they have in common? Oh yeah, they both sucked. They were both horrible. So maybe you want to kind of rethink that whole lower CO2 emissions is better, right? Now this is just correlation, it's not causation, but it is a thing that makes you go, to continue on with our early 90s pop song, hip hop song themes, right? Things that make you go, Second thing, I'm constantly disappointed. My heart shrinks three sizes. It does a reverse Grinch, to continue with our Grinch theme here. Constantly doing a reverse heart Grinch or Grinch heart because people don't talk about this fact. In 2018, Nobel laureate, he won it in 2018, Nobel laureate William Nordhaus, he won the Nobel, and his DICE model, dynamic model here for predicting integrated climate change costs, he predicted the cost, if we do nothing, doing nothing by 2100, the cost would be $20 or $30 trillion. Well, we've already seen that much cost from just COVID, and we aren't even a fifth of the way through the century, right? So maybe, just maybe, climate change predicted cost $20 to $30 trillion by 2100, and we've already had that much cost just in the first 20 years from this pandemic. Maybe climate change isn't quite the end all and be all of concerns in this 21st century. Well, I know that that's sacrilege, but maybe some other things, bioweapons, biohazards, war, governments, maybe these things deserve a little bit more attention. All right, folks, we're going to have to wind it up there for today. And I will see you tomorrow. Maybe we'll get to SCOTUS, and we're definitely going to have a poetry day tomorrow. This is Frank. Find me at ADK Homeroom on Twitter. Remember to subscribe. Thank you for listening, and take care.